Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Welcome to Drinks Insider 2025. I'm your host, Felicity Carter. The first guest of the year is none other than the very insightful Brian Roth, journalist, director of insights at Sightlines, the research outfit for beverage companies, as well as consumer and market analyst at the Feel Goods Company. Now, what makes him such a great resource is that he doesn't just look at beverage data, but at social and economic trends in general, so he can spot emerging patterns that other people miss. In this episode, we talk about some of those wider trends and how they're impacting the beverage market, particularly beverage alcohol. As always, the takeaways will be in the Drinks Insider newsletter, which you can find at drinksinsider.com, and it's free to sign up. Now, if you have an idea for the show, or if you've just got some gossip, send it my way. You can reach me at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Brian, fantastic to see you again.
A treat to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, okay, so I think it's going to be a treat for listeners because your depth of knowledge about the beverage market is just astounding. So to kick off 2025, what trends did you see in 2024?
Yeah, as I've been trying to think about what ideas of trends mean to people, I think it's so easy to look at real specific tangible things. People often point toward a specific style of wine, style of beer, a format. But what connected to me when I'm thinking about what happened in 24 and what's going to matter in 25, I came across what I think is strongly a strong way to think about it is an idea, a behavior, and then one of those kind of tangible things. So for me, a key trend, an idea, was one of confusion. I've had so many conversations with investors, with company founders over the course of the last 12 months, where there's just a desire to have a better grasp of what's going on. And that's partially just because the market across beverage alcohol and beyond is just so varied wide and things happen at a rapid pace. So I think there is a lot of reliance on anecdote, and there are more questions than answers, and then there end up being more efforts to find anecdote than the data and context that's necessary. So I thought that, you know, it's certainly kind of an evergreen thing, but I really believe in the last year, I've heard some version of that in conversations more than I have ever before.
Yeah, we're going to pause there because I'll come back to what you've seen in the last year. But what I'm so impressed by is your depth of data and insight. Where does it come from? What's your process?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. You know, when I talk about what I do with my colleague Kate Bernat at Sightlines, we're very particular to emphasize we are not a data company. You know, I think there are a lot of organizations out there that will throw data at you, tell you what that data is quite literally, and then that's the end of the story. So I am pulling data from consumer trends, surveys, work on our own, in which we engage with consumers across the country. We're pulling sales information from Nielsen, Circana, government information from that's collected by the U.S. federal government. The goal being is that when we present information and ideas to people, it is built from a rich tapestry of sources. So we are not reliant on or off-premise only. We are not reliant on, you know, people who are industry insiders only. We are pulling from over a decade of experience and information from everywhere, because that's the way that I feel like you get the best view of what's actually happening.
Good. All right. Let's go back to trends because I cut you off. Okay. So there's the confusion. That's definitely a trend. What else have you been seeing?
Convenience, which is a behavior. And I think, you know, this certainly can be tied back to the way that shoppers, not just in the US but elsewhere, started to change some of what they did in the way that they interacted with shopping behaviors during COVID, but has really shifted and held in the years past. So one way that I like to illustrate this, and something that we covered on Sightlines this past year, was if you look at the number of shopping trips Americans are making on an annual basis, 2019, so pre-pandemic, versus 2024, we're making on average about 2 added shopping trips a month to grocery, convenience, you know, gas, whatever it may be. But we are buying the same number of products that we are 5 years ago.
I honestly thought when you started speaking that you were going to say we're making less shopping trips now because we're doing everything online, not more. So what accounts for doing more?
There is an emotional attachment to the idea of shopping now, perhaps more so than before. I say little treat culture. This is a phrase that has certainly permeated over the course of 2024. There is just a lot more in the moment shopping choices. And I think there is both a conscious choice, because these are ways that we can find things that bring us pleasure. It's kind of that, spontaneous decision that we might get used to making at the checkout line. You know, we've got that shelf of candy or magazines or bottles of drinks that years ago, that was the only way that we might think about impulse buying. But in reality, because of the ease of shopping, or just the way that we've gotten used to shopping in the moment, impulse buying just occurs more readily now. So, you know, part of this increase in shopping trips can easily be pointed to the fact of, okay, maybe people are just looking for better deals. Things are more expensive now. You're a bit more conscious with the way you spend your money. So maybe you're willing to, say, go to your chain grocery store that's a mile away to get your groceries, but you know that maybe you can get even better produce at another store, so you're making a second stop. But even then, we're still talking about a sort of indulgent impulse buy there too. Where I would draw the most inspiration for this, and perhaps most important, is the rise of convenience stores, in the U.S. specifically, as motivation for this happening. So the behavior that we've created shopping at a convenience store, in which more Americans are shopping at more than ever, is spilling over into the way that we think about and interact with our shopping behaviors elsewhere. We go in, we buy a handful of items that we need for that day. And then maybe 2 or 3 days later is when we make an additional shopping trip to fill up whatever we need again.
Okay, so this is obviously got huge implications for beverages. Mm-hmm. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking about the single serve trend in wine, like cans. And that's been very much tied to abstention. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's also tied to the impulse purchase. What do you think?
Yeah, the one of the wonderful things about single serves is that, especially at a time when the array of options is bigger than it's ever been before, whether we're talking about alcohol or non-alcoholic drinks, is that there is the ability to try and experiment in ways that just have not been available before. So we've always had a shelf of single serve options, but never have we had before the vast kind of sea of brands and flavor experiences that it offers too. So, you know, the idea of walking into a convenience store, spending $2.50 to $3 US on a can of beer or a flavored malt beverage, you know, we can now walk in and we have a choice of dozens of options there too. That wasn't the case 5 years ago. The ability to, again, find these moments of indulgence, finding moments in which you can do something special for yourself, is not just more readily available, but it's also, you can't plan for that, right? Like, I can't plan 3 days from now the mood I'm going to be in and the thing that's going to bring me joy in that exact moment.
Not yet. Eventually your smartwatch will be able to predict
AI
that.
AI hopefully will give me a little assistance, right? It'll start monitoring my circadian rhythms and tell me, okay, Brian, you need an IPA.
It's going to say, next Tuesday, don't get out of bed. It's just going to be a bad day. Okay, so this is all very interesting. So I read a study that said that in fast-moving consumer goods, that brand loyalty was actually dropping. Is that true in beverages, do you think? And is that tied to just there's so much choice, there's no point in sticking with one thing anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is just inherent to the way that the market is, right? And so this is something that I often tell founders and people who read Sightlines or clients that I talk to, where, you know, we currently have the most diverse collection of drinkers that have ever existed in the country's history. This is an objective fact. Who get to choose from the widest array of drinks that have ever existed in our country's history. Also a fact. So the sheer idea that you can find the thing that's going to meet your mood, it's going to provide you either a feeling or a flavor that you really desire and are looking for in that moment is the highest probability that has ever existed. So of course, if we're talking about legacy brands losing, you know, a little bit of share here or there, there's just a mathematical game being played, right? That you can find these new upstart brands that are existing that are doing things a little bit different inherently from the brands and products that have been around forever. So the idea that, you know, Poppy or Olipop or any other collection of a gut-healthy soda chips away from, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi regular, this is just, we're just playing math at this point. And it also, again, builds into broader consumer trends and interests in the way that people are searching for new flavors or getting something more out of a food or beverage that they purchase too. So I would absolutely buy into this idea that, yes, legacy brands have it harder, but by virtue of being a legacy brand, you should always have it harder, right? You're around for a long time, and maybe you have the general loyalty, and you have the placements, the shelf placements, certainly. But just by virtue of existing for a long time, there's just, it's a linear challenge.
Okay, so one of the things, of course, when you get a proliferation of brands is now you now start to get the paradox of choice, which is choice becomes paralyzing. Yeah. One of the things that you've talked about, which I really liked, is you used the phrase the invisible barrier of choice. Can you talk about what the invisible barrier is and give some examples of how it can be overcome?
Yeah. Would you like to do an imagination experiment with me, if you may?
I would love to do an imagination experiment.
So here's a good place to start, is that if you were to close your eyes right now and think about a shelf set, we'll say wine, for example, that when you think in your mind of seeing what that shelf is, you're probably seeing a variety of grape varietals. You know, you look one way, it's red, one way, it's white. The consumer does not see the option of, I would like to buy an alcoholic drink tonight, in that same way. So the idea of wine, for example, in this experiment, being a competitor with another wine is not the way this works for consumers today. Mm-hmm. What a consumer sees is that, okay, we've got wine over here, but then there's beer right there that is flavored, that maybe has flavoring or can give me an experience that tastes like the peach or the stone fruit. Oh, but then another step over, there's seltzer that can do that too. And even if we expand it, just to think about holistically across stores and purchase opportunities, you know, wine used to think it competes with wine, beer, and spirits, or just wine. When in reality, when you think about a consumer and the way that they choose across categories today, in the U.S., two-thirds of drinkers consume across beer, wine, and spirits. So they're thinking of across all these things. All of a sudden, your competition is not just wine, beer, or spirits. If I'm a beer drinker, it's also competing with tequila, Buzz Balls, which is a wine spirit hybrid single serve option. It's competing against FMBs like Twisted Tea. Everything is competition against everything. So maybe if your indulgence on a Tuesday night is going to be wine and chocolate, or cookies and milk, right? The competition for an alcoholic beverage is not another alcoholic beverage. The competition is now cookies and milk. Or it could be a fancy dessert. It could be TH drinks. It could be anything that fits an occasion where there's going to be something different filling up that time and space. And so to get back to the invisible barrier of choice, the idea is that we have an almost infinite, it feels like, collection of ideas and products that can fill what we're looking for. And so to minimize the friction for consumers is really, really important. I think an example that I recently gave was with a website, The Zero Proof, where if you go to the website and they have a section, a pull-down tab called Occasions, and it's all vibes. It's like you're watching Netflix, you're staying in for dinner. The idea of helping someone select a beverage for that occasion is taking a consumer point of view, that they're just looking for something, they're looking for ease in choosing something that fits what they're doing in that moment. And we also see this in terms of individual brands too. So Beatbox, which is 11% ABV, legally it's wine, but you will never ever hear anybody from that company say the word wine. They are a party punch. That is who they are. Mm. They're removing that barrier of anything else. They are for parties. They're a party punch. There's a great small upstart wine brand based in New England here in the US called Pizza Wine. This is a wine for pizza. That's easy. They focused on-premise opportunities with pizzerias, and they're removing this option. If I walk into a pizzeria and I'm scanning a beverage menu and I see pizza wine, that's it, right? It's removing this invisible barrier of, oh, I got to look through all these different options to figure something out. There's a beer that I really like out of Texas. St. Elmo Brewing is the name of the company. They have a beer called Carl. If you look really, really hard on the small type on the bottom of the can in a font and color that almost matches the can itself, it says Kolsch. It says, I think, Kolsch style air. Nobody knows what a Kolsch is. An average drinker has no idea, but they do recognize
that's almost,
that.
That's almost a copyright infringement. That's a clever name.
Well, it's, Carl as, you know, like the name of the person, right? The idea,
I understand, but it's also kind of a bit like Carlsberg.
Ah, I see what you mean. Yeah. Well, the key here, and you know, maybe to paint this contrast, you know, Carlsberg, so based on tradition, its icon. Carl, the St. Elmo's beer, is all about personality. It is built, the aesthetic, and the whole goal of this is our personality of this beer is bigger than a confusing style to people too.
Right.
And so over and over again, we can look at these examples where when you have this just array of options to choose from, trying to make the decision just a little bit easier for somebody can make a world of difference in terms of, you know, they have 3 seconds to look at what they're holding in their hands and decide if they want to buy it or not.
Yeah, I mean, this is as you're probably well aware, this is an obsessive conversation within wine about, you know, how do you differentiate something where there's 400,000 different, you know, offers. Okay, so let's just go back to trends. I'll just finish this off and then I want to ask you about some specific.
Yeah.
Did any trends come out of nowhere last year that really surprised you, or was it all just continuation of life as usual?
There was a trend that, so at toward the end of 2023, Kate Bernat and I, you know, we're talking about things that we're seeing in the marketplace and what we can create and share on Sightlines that are going to keep people a little bit ahead of the game. The thing that we identified that we did a multi-part series on was carbonation. It wasn't a terrible surprise to me when that became more of a conversation piece in 2024. However, I think I feel emboldened and heartened that more people are recognizing it as an important trend to consumers, and it is important for
companies.
Tell me
about carbonation, because that one went over me as well. I didn't notice. Tell me about carbonation.
Sure. Yeah. So I think there's kind of a multi-part step for a way to think about this, right? So this gets back to a little bit of what I was saying about the ease of finding a particular beverage brand that fits what you want in that moment, whatever that is, right? So American drinkers have more choices than ever before. And one of the things that they are increasingly becoming aware of is texture. The texture of the drinks that they consume.
Huh.
You know, this has started, I mean, really, this goes back a little bit to maybe about 2016, 2017. something that I covered a lot in the rise of hard seltzer, but the existence of in-home products, it could be a soda stream in which you are creating something that you have full control over the amount of carbonation. Flavored sparkling water brands were certainly big on this. The rise of Topo Chico, which is so unique in its mineral content and the way that it is carbonated, that people recognize it as special and unique. That, you know, this is leading to increased awareness of carbonation levels. So we have more choices. We can start thinking about texture, but also we have more products. Whether we are buying it pre-made or we can make it ourselves, it simply are going to have varying degrees of carbonation. So this is when brands start to use texture, use carbonation as a mark. So there's going to be degrees of carbonation and viscosity. One of the best examples here in the U.S. is Twisted Tea. It's a flavored malt beverage. It is non-carbonated. It's one of the best-selling alcoholic brands in the country. And this is whether you are you're talking to consumers all over, and this is something I have done personally, especially young consumers. They talk about that brand for its uniqueness because it leaves them less bloated. You know, like there's as you're drinking a can of Twisted Tea, it is you know, silkier in its texture compared to, say, a beer that would be chosen in contrast. And it's also just making that person hyper aware of, I keep going back to choose Twisted Tea. There's something different about the way that this just interacts with my body.
Half of my brain is marveling at human ingenuity to change levels of carbonation. And the other half of me thinks it's the end of civilization when we're talking about levels of carbonation. Well, I can recognize this one because it's ever so slightly minerally.
There's something really special about it too, though, because, you know, and this gets back to the consumer today, which is increasingly a younger consumer, like 20-something consumers, and we'll talk about alcoholic beverage specifically here, they are more well-versed than any other generation, no surprise, in understanding and educating themselves on differentiating factors that matter to them. So, you know, I've had, and Kate has had as well for Sightlines, just numerous conversations with 20-somethings over the course of the last couple of years to try to better understand, you know, we hear things in the market, and there's only so many times that I can hear a middle-aged person like myself talk about it before. Like, I just need to go to the source and hear about, you know, why this matters. So, you know, for example, a couple months ago, Kate spoke to a trio of college students at Northern Arizona University here in the U.S., Izzy, Ruby, and Hannah, who very specifically talked about either how much they loved bubbles. Hannah, I believe it was, who said, hates bubbles, cannot stand it. She specifically likes to drink juice because you're avoiding carbonation altogether.
And maybe she likes acidity as well.
Well, true. She cited that she didn't like energy drinks because a lot of energy drinks have carbonation. To be a 22-year-old or a 21-year-old to articulate that is truly unique amongst a consumer base that just probably was not widely known or accepted or talked about several years ago.
It raises so many questions in my head about, you know, because being able to tell fine graded things like that is a real skill. And I wonder, is it because there's just been such an explosion of food in the last 15, 20 years? Is it because people are much more aware of what they put into their bodies ever since Michael Pollan wrote Omnivore's Dilemma and people recognized how awful the food chain was for the first time? I mean, that is an extraordinary ability to talk about very fine-grained things. Where do you think it's coming from?
Well, I don't think it's fine-grained things at all. We interact with so many varieties of food and beverage products now. This is just lived experience. And if you are a 25-year-old who has spent, we'll say, 12 years, you've had some discretionary income. This could be chores around the house, an allowance, maybe you've worked a part-time job. You've had the ability to make choices as the number of choices and different choices in food and beverage has just grown. So the idea, and I'm not talking about being able to identify specific levels of pressure in carbonation. But understanding
not
that
yet.
I have
asking 5 years.
But understanding that, like, maybe you have had a Topo Chico, so you very clearly and distinctly understand that is that feels highly carbonated and just has a different drinking experience than a regular Pepsi, versus if you choose, say, a hard tea, which is a subcategory of flavored malt beverages in the U.S. that has grown rapidly. These are three very different drinking experiences that in reality probably happen in some version almost every single day. So you're experiencing three different versions of carbonation that I'm not asking, Jane Drinker to tell me the fine grained details of it, but I'm pretty sure if I asked her about, what are the different feelings you're getting from each of these things, that she would be able to articulate, oh, this one's far more fizzier, it's more bubbly than this other one. And I think that is just, it's just a compounding nature of what we get to choose from.
Okay, so this brings up a second question. So all the research, including stuff that I've been involved in, keeps saying that younger consumers are flavor forward. So what does being flavor forward mean in practice? Does that mean they want to keep trying new things? Does it mean they want to embrace drinks that are literally flavored? Does it mean, what does it actually mean?
Yes. The answer is yes to all those. Okay, so we can start with the literal, which I think is really, really important. Flavored things. So in the U.S., I like to use this example, lager or Kolsch, which we've already talked about. These are traditional foundational beer styles. But also, if you look at off-premise chain retail sales, flavored versions of these drinks are now slowly becoming the plurality of brands that are sold. So for Kolsch, I think it's actually over 50%. For lager, I believe it's somewhere around a quarter to a third of off-premise brands that are sold would be lagers that have flavor added to it.
And the biggest selling wine is Stella Rosa, which of course has
exactly
flavored ingredients.
And that is a great brand to point toward, because what Stella Rosa does, and increasingly other upstart wine brands who are embracing added flavor to it, but then also just trying to emphasize even the natural flavors that they get, is that, again, it's a consumer perspective. A consumer who is drinking across multiple alcohol categories and getting tons of different flavor experiences is now seeing that, a Stella Rosa pineapple chili wine is in reality probably closer toward a canned margarita in their mind and in their experience than white wine. And even Stella Rosa has recipes for how to use their flavored wines as ingredients in cocktails too. So from a very direct literal standpoint of flavor, these are just, they're wonderful entry points, but they're all just fun to drink. I think it's easy to miss the fact that no matter what your age is, you like things that taste sweet. You're human. And so This is not to belittle companies or brands that choose to build a product that has flavor or relies on an idea of fruit or mimicking something that we enjoy. Like, this is just, you are catering to the desires of consumers in just a human core way. So that's a literal part of flavor.
Now, you use the term entry point, and that's always the question, particularly in the wine category, which I know more about, that are these an entry into the market or do they become an end in itself, do you think? Is there any data around this?
I would argue that, well, it depends on the perspective of what entry point is, right? Because if you're a producer and you're thinking about, oh, well, You know, I have an entry-level wine that's easy to drink. Well, that's not what the consumer's thinking about. The consumer is thinking about, you know, Stella Rosa is a brand that's widely available in just about any single chain retail outlet that sells wine. So not only is it present and in front of them, that's an entry point, but it also gives them, you know, an easy on-ramp to a category that, I mean, for a lot of just average people is challenging to get into. It has a lot of traditional baggage.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking about having lunch in Lyon, which is a food center, and the first thing they do is bring out a red wine that's got, I think, black brew liqueur or something in it. It's you know, or sangria, I think, speak to all of that. All right, so let's talk about specific categories of drinks. So sure. Tequila. Tell me about tequila. Yeah. What's happening with that?
Right now, the story that you'll hear in the U.S. is that the challenge for tequila is that it is declining in sales. There's a caveat to that, however. So tequila, the base for the number one with a bullet cocktail in America, the margarita, what you see right now is people trading down a little bit. So this, of course, is not unique to this moment in time. Pandemic era spending, you know, in the U.S. we were receiving government stimulus checks. There were a lot of alcohol categories that were thriving because if you look at retail spending across, does not matter, generation, household income, whatever it may be, there is a direct correlation when you look at the month that, so this would be 2020 through 2021, that stimulus checks were sent to people and then retail spending by whatever group, the entirety of the country altogether. So there are a lot of alcohol categories that thrived, say, between 2020 and 22, because we're talking about money coming in. Tequila has just been on this incredible run and incredible rise. The spirits industry here, rightly so, benchmarks sales to dollar sales. Because by doing it by volume is harder for sure, because it's a smaller volume on a higher price point. That's just the way spirits work. But if you look at volumes, what is actually happening is that, so rather than somebody, say, spending $60 on a bottle of Casamigos, which here we know as George Clooney's tequila, they're trading down to something that's in like the $40 to $50 range. So it's staying within the category, and you have people in spirits especially who feel very attached to some brands. But in reality, when you look at the entirety of the market and what's happening with consumers more holistically, we see tequila still performing really well, but instead of the ultra premium high end, it's high end or super high end. So, and you're probably,
I mean, that's one of the most interesting, a greater sort of economic trends at the moment is everybody thought that the luxury market was just unassailable, and the luxury market mm-hmm. in general has begun to fall apart in ways that people didn't expect. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that. But my understanding from the outside is that tequila has been so big that, do you think the market is just oversaturated and due for a correction, or is it on and on and on?
That's hard to say, especially right now, because part of the challenge in the U.S. has to do with inventories. And again, this is backed up going back to COVID as well. So the idea of linear growth and what that means in terms of that on and on and on in this moment, I think, is hard to forecast. But the important thing, and when we're looking at least thinking about what could happen ahead, we still need to think about it in terms of just like what Americans feel excited about. And so even if there's backed up inventories, tequila continues to sell. So maybe Casamigos now gets stuck and is on the shelf or in warehouses longer, but Don Julio is now moving double digits faster than it was before. So there's a balancing act there too. So again, it's difficult when you talk about a category at large where so much narrative, especially when it's based on dollars specifically, has been pinned on one section of it. When you start looking at the broader category here, tequila, and also, again, you're thinking about it from a consumer mindset where trading down from Casamigos to Don Julio may not actually feel like any change at all. Tequila might just be tequila, because people are using it in cocktails rather than, okay, I'm ready to pour my 2 ounces of tequila neat at the end of the night. Like, that's not traditionally how it's going to be served here. So I think there's multiple variables at play here. The momentum continues to be behind tequila, for example, and there's a lot of entries that continue to come into the market. But also, again, like, this matters when we talk about slowdown, it matters about where we look, about where that slowdown is happening, not representative of the entirety of the category overall.
I suppose one of the things I should ask you about is the overall sales of alcohol. I remember when we spoke last year, you said, nobody cares about your base fermentable. People are still drinking the same amount of alcohol. It's just shifting, you know, which category they're doing. Is that still true?
Yes. I mean, in the U.S., you benchmark things to 2.5 gallons of ethanol every year. And, you know, it fluctuates a little bit up and down throughout history. I mean, we can literally look backwards almost, you know, 100 years in terms of ethanol consumption rates. And things will fluctuate. But for what matters right now is that number is consistent.
Right. So does that mean there are some people who are just drinking more all of a sudden? Or, you know, because we do know that there's, well, actually, so younger people talk, there's a lot of talk about abstention. Is it true?
Sure. In terms of a broad swath of demographics, just saying, no, I don't drink, absolutely not. And this plays out not just in consumer data or survey data, but in conversations that we have with young people as well. I do not worry about the long-term impact of younger generations and their drinking behavior right now. And here's actually, I'll tie this into what you just asked too about drinking rates as well, because I think this is a really, really important context. So one of those things that we look at in the US when we think about ethanol consumption rates, so the way that's divvied up is beer, wine, spirits, the big mega categories. Everything is, you cannot do an apples to apples comparison because of the wide range of ABV, right? So what happens is you use a formula to condense it down into like a level playing field, essentially. And then you just look at it from strict ethanol. What am I consuming and how much? What has changed there, especially over the last 20 to 25 years, is there's been a decrease in the share of beer that has made up this 2.5 gallons and an increase in spirits. So the big difference there, of course, we get back to ABV. So if I'm no longer drinking a 4.2% Bud Light, which for many people 20 years ago, Bud Light, Miller Lite, Coors Light, this was just the natural entry point, versus now, even if you're drinking, maybe it's a cocktail, which is obviously way higher in alcohol content, that's going to change that drinking occasion significantly. Even if we want to talk about, okay, I'm not drinking a Bud Light, I'm drinking a hard seltzer or a spirit-based seltzer, we're still talking about more alcohol. We're talking about 4.5% to 5% alcohol now.
Can I repeat back to you what I think you've said?
Please.
What I think you've said is that the level of ethanol is consistent, but it may be fewer people drinking higher alcohol drinks.
Fewer people drinking lower alcohol drinks in this scenario that I'm painting here, right? So if you're drinking less beer, traditionally we'll say, we'll just stamp it with 5% ABV. For a traditional beer.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But if you're drinking more spirits, so say if I'm drinking, say, 10% less beer because I'm drinking 10% more spirits, I'm also by pure technical definition consuming more alcohol. So my volume of beer is going to go lower, while my volume of spirits isn't going to be a lot, but the alcohol I consume is more.
What I'm saying is you can get the same... You can get the same total ethanol if you get people drop out of the beer category and not go to any other category, but people who were drinking wine start drinking cocktails. Mm-hmm. And then, you know what I mean? You can have fewer drinkers but still have more ethanol in that scenario that you're talking about, if I understand properly what you're saying. So,
yeah.
So the ethanol won't be evenly distributed across drinkers, I guess. It's a very interesting point.
Yeah,
so
where
do you see the future?
Well, right now, by virtue of what's available on the market and the way that consumers are kind of focusing their attention, the tailwinds behind spirits are just really, really important. And amongst this scenario, too, I have to point out, wine basically has not changed in a generation. For Americans, the consumption level of wine has stuck, I think, between 11 and 14% or so. Like, there's just no fluctuation there. And so if you're thinking about what happens moving forward, it's not just, okay, so Brian's saying spirits are taking up more share of ethanol consumption. That means that vodka, you know, bourbon, tequila, that's where all the action's going to happen. It's everything within the category of spirits too.
Okay, so let's just go back to the wine hasn't budged. So the perception inside wine is that sales are falling. So what do you know what's holding steady then if the overall numbers are the same? So how do you reconcile the perception of falling sales with the same number? Is it
the? I mean, it is a blunt way to ask it, but like, why do people care about wine? And I'm not asking that and saying that in like in a mean way. But this is a question that
is
asked about any category.
This is a safe space podcast. You can say exactly what like, you think. Be blunt as you like.
What the answer to that question is going to be very different for every generation too. And I don't. Yeah. And so even if we want, let's zone in on an alternative like beatbox. Beatbox technically is wine. And if you remove that, say, from the small volume boxed wine segment, all of a sudden numbers for that segment look very, very different because it moves just millions of cases. If you were to ask a young drinker if they would prefer that or, I don't know, some kind of fanciful high-end wine, you're going to get a variety of opinions because beatbox is fun and brings a very specific flavor experience and flavor proposition and brand position. And so the idea of asking, you know, why should I care about wine is indicative to wine's problem that, you know, it is, I'm broad brushstrokes here. It is expensive. It has a history where it is not as easily accessible emotionally to young people, whereas they can make a choice about, you know, just about anything else and not have to worry about wasting $30 on one single bottle. That's a really big difference. There is just an emotional core to it. There is a logical money-driven core to it too. And it's part of it is just what I see from some companies, a lack of interest in speaking a language to young people who are not speaking a language that was used 40 years ago. And that's just brand evolution. That just has to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even with my own family, when it was my niece, you know, she's got an aunt who's a wine writer, didn't touch it. No, it was cocktails. All right. So let's go back to, categories of things. High-end vodka. Tell me what's happening there.
Vodka is really interesting, especially with high-end, because this gets here's the great parallel to the tequila is tequila. Like, vodka is vodka. There's just not...
Vodka is vodka, absolutely.
Not, by pure definition, not a lot happening there. Marketing has always been the centerpiece for vodka brands, and to separate itself and to present specific brands as elevated, therefore deserving the extra spend. Grey Goose is perhaps one of the best examples of this. Here in America, still kind of seen as the penultimate vodka to choose for your cocktail. So for high-end vodka, you know, there's still a little bit of interest and success there purely because if you have the money and the wherewithal, and this is not most consumers, like you are attached to the ideals of brand, and that's just great brand positioning, communication. Whereas for the vast majority of U.S. consumers, vodka is going to be vodka. So the idea, again, if we're talking about like we did on tequila, trading down a little bit, going from one to the other, you know, vodka traditionally is going to be more specific as a alcohol base that you layer flavor upon. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, flavored vodka has been around forever, no surprise here, but even premium vodka, so more of the higher end by pure dollar point, have found success looking through the lens of more contemporary flavor. Like Smirnoff, I think it was last year, had a lot of success with their spicy tamarind. I believe it was, brand. Like a willingness to play in a contemporary flavor, it's going to be higher price point. So even when we talk about high-end vodka, so like Grey Goose Traditional, we still need to talk about the flavored offshoots that start to matter there as well.
All right, next one. Canadian whiskey. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Oh, are you sensing a theme here with flavor?
I am. I want to hear your take on that too.
If you look at control state data, so here in the U.S., a collection of states, spirit sales are controlled by the states themselves. And so, you know, there's a mix and match of legalities, how different states sell. But control state data is maintained really easy to track, which makes things like this fun. So if you look at what's growing right now in control state spirit sales, it's RTDs. Okay, no surprise. Tequila, sure. And Canadian whiskey specifically. Now, why is that happening?
Why Canadian whiskey?
I would argue it is because Crown Royal is the defining brand for Canadian whiskey. And Crown Royal, as the core traditional whiskey, is not doing great and hasn't done particularly well, I'd say, for the last 3 to 4 years. What is doing great for Crown Royal is all their flavored variants. Last year, the 2023 would have been Salted Caramel was just went gangbusters for them.
I can understand that actually. That combination of flavors would be awesome.
And it pairs very well with that experience. Like it rounds things out very nicely. Blackberry was the flavor of choice in 2024.
Blackberry doesn't quite speak to me as much as Salted Caramel. It doesn't quite. I can imagine a blackberry beer, but whiskey. Okay.
I learned just recently, Von Payne, I believe, is the name of the whiskey based in the Southwest here in the U.S., a black currant flavored whiskey that small in scale, but velocities are moving great. And well, here's the example for Crown Royal. Just pulling up a number really quick here. So Crown Royal Blackberry is probably going to end up close to 400,000 cases sold in 2024. And Crown Royal
Somebody needs to revive the Leon idea and stick some blackberry liqueur inside a red wine. It's going to go gangbusters.
Kind of the traditional example here in the U.S. too, and this is technically Canadian whiskey, Fireball. So Fireball, it's about 2/3 of the flavored whiskey market. You can find growth from all sorts of flavors. But the really unique thing about Fireball is that in the U.S., again, because of legal challenges, you know, you can't sell spirits in just any store. But what Sazerac did is they made a flavored malt beverage version of Fireball so that you can sell in convenience stores or grocery stores. And the taste is basically the same exact thing. And that also sold like wildfire. And this gives a really good anecdote to what we talk about when we talk about flavor, and especially in Canadian whiskey, the success of that, the way that it transfers. Fireball was selling a lot, whether it's the spirit-based or kind of the mock version, that FMB base. What you have here is not people who are seeking out individual fermentable bases. They are seeking Fireball, right? You have a Fireball customer who is dedicated to that. And so, you know, thinking about how we pull that out to the broader flavor market, you know, you have people who are fans of Crown Royal now who are not fans of Crown Royal, the straight Canadian whiskey. They love it because they just can't get enough of Crown Royal Peach, which became like a viral sensation in 23, or vanilla, or blackberry. Like these things just carry so much emotional weight. They really kind of punch out of their weight class in terms of loyalty amongst consumers.
Goodness. I can kind of, if I squint, I can imagine blackberry, but some of the other vanilla maybe, but some of the others. All right. So RTDs, can they keep growing? And especially what happens if there's a tariff on aluminium?
Yeah. The tariff question, that one we need to punt, sadly, unfortunately.
I'm just gonna have to wait and see.
Yeah, so context, you know, similar to the last Trump presidency, as we're talking right now, President-elect Trump has talked about instituting tariffs between 10 and 25%, especially on neighboring countries. So that includes Canada and Mexico. Canada in particular, very, very important for the aluminum trade. So part of the difference, I think, this time around, one is we also just don't know how that's going to play out, because the first time around, there just wasn't any precedent. So I think the countries, I shouldn't say I think, I know the countries right now are doing a lot of legwork, Canada especially, in terms of trying to maybe ease some of those threats a little bit and improve relations in ways that could benefit these sectors like aluminum. I'm not too worried about that. Companies are aware of what could happen, both producers as well as manufacturers. Yes, yeah. So there's a way to mitigate that. The biggest part of your question, like, so what's going on with RTDs kind of continued growing? The answer I would say is yes. And part of the reason for that would be just the sheer array of ways that these products and their flavors and what they mean can continue to evolve and change. So it depends on what you want to throw into the RTD bucket. Like, this could be hard seltzer, or this could be spirit-based things, which I think is often kind of industry thought here for something like High Noon. But there's enough change happening. There's enough brands entering the market. There's a certain collection of sophistication that's also happening here. So we're moving, say, from here is a black cherry flavored vodka seltzer to something that more closely mimics cocktails that you might find in an on-premise experience too. So there's just a lot of white space. Now, how brands can hold on to that and especially hold any loyalty is an entirely different proposition. But as a category, it is clear that it is just simply core to spirits especially.
Yeah, okay. I want to shift the conversation slightly and talk about an article I read in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, which is something about a phenomenon that you've also spoken about, which is the shift to day drinking. So people are not hanging out late at night anymore. They're going out and at 9 o'clock they're knocking off whatever they're doing and they're going home and they're going to bed, that sleeping has become really important. So what effect has this shift towards earlier and earlier consumption had on the market?
Yes. So let's start with the sleep, because that's a really great way to think about it too. So the U.S. government for years has been coordinating a survey called the American Time Use Survey. They take a representative sample of Americans, and then they basically divvy up all of the activities that they do during the day around work, play, cleaning the house, making food, whatever it may be. One of them obviously sleeping. Regardless of what generation you want to talk about, this is universal across ages, Americans are sleeping now more than they have at any point in the last 25 years. We are engaging, you know, this is variables. I have a 15-month-old daughter. My nights are going to be way different than a friend who does not have children. But broadly speaking, we're sleeping more than ever. So something's got to give. And increasingly, what that is late nights. And this started showing up in the early opening days post-COVID, where people were turning, you know, that 5 o'clock happy hour into a 3 o'clock late lunch with a drink. And you can find examples of this all over. Yelp has seen restaurant seating double in the hours of 2 to 5 p.m. from 2019. It's not a lot, but it went up from 5% of diners to 10% of diners between 2 to 5 p.m. Uber, the car share service, recently reported that trips to restaurants were up 10% from 4 to 5 p.m. and down almost 10% after 8 p.m.
And has this changed what people are drinking? Or have they just shifted the hours that they do it in?
So, it depends. And this gets back to a lot of what we've talked about, too. So CGA by NAQ, which tracks on-premise sales, has shown that cocktail sales have actually increased earlier in the day. So on-premise cocktail sales from 12 to 3 p.m., here we are, I'm looking at the data now, increased almost 30% versus year prior, 10 p.m. onward, minus 9%. So anything basically before 10 p.m. has grown in share, while after 10 p.m. has declined.
That's really interesting talking about cocktails during the day. That's almost like going back to the Mad Men era where, you know, that was very common. And it's very uncommon. Now, it's fascinating. Well, let's talk about another social trend which you've talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
The multi-generations, more people from the same generation living under one roof. Now, that's actually come up in other countries. I mean, they've done that in Europe for a very long time, and it's starting to happen in England because of housing prices. And, of course, if you're living with your mum and your dad, you simply can't drink the way you would if you were on your own. So what's happening in the American market?
Yeah, so 2024 was a particularly important year for that. It was the, I believe it was 17% of homes sold were specifically purchased for multi-generational households. It's the highest level ever.
Way higher than I would have expected. I would have expected if you said 2% or 3%, 17%. That's, hang on a second. Is that people in the sandwich generation who are having to take care of their kids and take care of the parent that's now unable to care for themselves?
Well, here's the beauty of it, and this was born out of a multi-part series that we did on Sightlines, is the reasons are multitude. I think the easiest and shortest path that we often draw here is there's a multi-generational household because young people don't have the money to rent or buy on their own, which is true. But also, you know, there are lots of examples, some of which we found in people and families we spoke to for Sightlines. You know, this is a middle-aged parent who one went through a divorce and so temporarily moved in with her parents with their child and now has been there for multiple years because they just enjoyed that living experience so much. For some people, it is because you have a parent who needs some amount of caregiving, and maybe, you know, you have a child along the way too. I don't want to pigeonhole it purely as a budgetary restriction. There are lots of variations. And I should also say, some people just like it too. Like, it's just nice. They feel close with their family in ways that this is just advantageous. And so what this does then, you know, this is easy to see. It changes the budget priorities in a very different way. And again, these are examples that we heard from people who are living in the scenario, and things that you can see from some of the sales and research too, is that, you know, a grandmother that we spoke to, for example, is now getting exposed to non-alc beer for the first time ever and gets to indulge in wine.
What was she drinking before?
Never had it before. That's the thing, right? And so
was she slugging back beers and now she's...
Yes. Just, here's a big thing to that point exactly. She used to drink wine and really liked wine, but I believe she was in her early 80s, that the idea of buying a bottle of wine was just a lot for her because if it's not being shared, it's just going to sit. But now with multiple people in the house, the idea of having a bottle of wine with a meal becomes a shared experience in the way it's meant to be. So that sale now happens to somebody for which it didn't. So we're talking about, you know, different velocities of different products now showing up in these homes. Premiumization all of a sudden becomes a little bit easier because it's shared budgets, a willingness to experiment. There was one family where I believe it was a son-in-law who spent his time during lockdown of COVID really learning more about Mai Tais and like tiki cocktail culture. And now there is an ingrained piece to that family's weekly behavior where he's exploring different kinds of tiki cocktails in ways that other people just wouldn't have ever experienced.
Just let me stop you. So you're talking about going out and speaking to people. Is this something that you do on a very structured basis? And how do you go and talk to university students or multi-generational people? Do you put a call out on LinkedIn and say, if you're living with your mum, I want to talk to you? Or how does it work?
So one of the benefits that Kate and I have for Sightlines, we have backgrounds in traditional journalism. So we function as we are analysts today, but our background, we cut our teeth talking to strangers. You know, especially for us working the beat years ago, this means you walk out onto the street and just start asking random people, hey, do you have a moment to chat? So it varies widely. You know, this could be trying to find people through social media. It could be trying to source friends of friends of friends. It's just kind of doing random searches, or it could just be stopping people on the street and saying, do you have a few moments to chat?
So you've turned journalism into a respectable business. Kudos.
Finally.
All right, I've got two more questions, which are really important. So I know nothing about the cannabis market.
Sure.
But so cannabis legalization, decriminalization is popping up all over Europe. So it will take a while, but eventually we're going to see, you know, infused drinks and so on like that. What can people expect? How has the market grown in the US? I know there's regulatory problems that have hindered the market in some ways, but does it cannibalize alcohol, or is it a but or is it an and?
No, it does not cannibalize alcohol, and I cannot emphasize that enough. My third trend, actually, that I was going to mention as like the tangible thing was cannabis, because it has been on the periphery of people's minds and conversations, but in 2024, by far, the most common question I was asked was about, is cannabis taking share from name your category? And, you know, the research that we have done for Sightlines, you could look at sales data, you could look at academic research, you could speak to people like we have done. There is just no evidence that specifically shows cannabis is stealing share away from alcohol categories. And in fact, in the US, people who use cannabis are actually spend higher amounts of their budget on alcohol. There is more crossover and also just different use cases. People associate cannabis with aspects of relaxation, pain management. Maybe you're at home by yourself on an evening where the idea of having a glass of wine is just not as interesting as the kind of the mellowness that you might get from consuming THC. I just cannot emphasize it enough. The narrative is very strong, where people suggest that these two things are constantly combating each other. And all of the research that we have done and others have done just pretty plainly shows that, again, like at this moment in time, you know, ask me 20 years from now, maybe it's different. But at this moment in time, there's just not cannibalization in the way that people fear.
Great. All right. Last question, or second last question.
I'm sure. Actually, I'm going to add one more thing, just because I want to underline that even more emphatically. States like California, Massachusetts, Colorado, where legal recreational cannabis has been available for up to 10 years in some cases, have actually seen double-digit increases in ethanol consumption during that time frame that cannabis has been legal. So, like, again, these things work together. They are not completely separate things. It's just like, you know, we can take a moment and to take a phrase from the cannabis culture, we can chill. We can chill.
Okay, so given that ethanol consumption hasn't changed over the years and what you just said about this next question is probably redundant, but I'll ask it anyway. How is the health conversation impacting the market, or isn't it?
I think people are plainly more aware of it, obviously. But broadly, I would not expect it to have significant long-term issues outside of what we're talking about, like in terms of volume changes too. So maybe people see, you know, drinking a 16-ounce can of beer is going to be a little bit different health-wise than maybe having a vodka soda or some kind of cocktail too. And, you know, we're also in the midst of the U.S. determining what its health guidelines are going to be for consumption of alcohol. That's a whole other kind of big topic to get into as well. But I wouldn't expect that to change.
I've spent many nights in Europe waiting up.
I'm preaching to the choir.
Waiting for the reports to come out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like my own personal waiting for Godot.
I guess like put it succinctly is that people are more aware of their health than ever before, but that has not changed their willingness to engage with indulgences, both in any realm of food or beverage. So, you know, even when we talk about some of the most successful alcohol brands in the country, I'll mention them again because we've talked about them already, Twisted Tea and Beatbox, these have a lot of calories and sugar, but you know what? People enjoy them. And so enjoyment is going to trump the way that they are actively or not actively thinking about, oh, I can't get, you know, X number of grams of sugar today. I can't drink that. Like, they want to drink it and it's fun, so they will.
So that's an incredibly optimistic way to start the new year. But before we go, I think everybody should watch your YouTube channel, and they should use your services because your insights are absolutely fantastic. So here's the floor is yours. Talk about what you do and how people and what you can do for brands.
Sure. Thank you. Sightlines.news is the website. Our insights platform, Sightlines, pulls information from across alcohol, cannabis, functional wellness, broader CPG, in order to create ideas and give context that are going to make decision makers smarter. We have subscribers from across all three tiers, from across a range of alcoholic and non-alcoholic categories. You know, our goal is we're going to present ideas on what's happening in the market with consumers in ways that's going to make people smarter and make them better at the conversations that they need to have in order to succeed. So Sightlines.news is the website there. We also have a podcast and an accompanying video version of it too, called The Gist by Sightlines. You can find that on Sightlines.news. That's a bi-weekly episode where in 20 minutes, we want to make it simple and succinct for people. Kate and I review three top stories from the past couple of weeks, give some data, some added context from our own reporting, and explain why things matter and why people know about them.
Yeah, and I highly recommend it. It's absolutely packed with information. So very much endorsed by Drinks Insider. So,
thank you.
Brian, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.